You never know what might happen here today. I'm sure that most of you saw the news last week about the tragic helicopter crash that took the lives of three individuals in the northern part of Florida on a transplant procedure. And Dr. John Noseworthy, the president and CEO of the Mayo Clinic, had planned to be with us here today, but is attending memorial services for those that were lost in that tragic accident. However, replacing Dr. Noseworthy today is one of his colleagues, Dr. Jim Kirkland, who is the director of the Center on Aging at the Mayo Clinic. Now, my wife Carmen and I were actually born at St. Mary's Hospital in Rochester, Minnesota, a few years ago. And so our clinic numbers start with a 1, which says something about how old we are. But it's always a treat to bring folks from our hometown to the sunny Gulf Coast of Florida. From a very early age, Dr. Kirkland was inspired by his grandfather in the way he lived. His grandfather lived well into his 90s, worked into his 80s, and his healthy life influenced Dr. Kirkland's decision to become a geriatrician. Dr. Kirkland wanted to find out more where the methods and scientific processes could be to help other people live the way his grandfather did. Jim has devoted his extensive medical research and teaching career in the development and advancement of aging research through partnerships across the United States and around the world. He currently is playing an instrumental role in creating an ongoing partnership on both sides of the Atlantic expanding area of research. In addition to his work at the Mayo Clinic, he currently is an associate editor of Obesity Research magazine and has spent more than 2 decades studying the mechanisms behind mad fat cells. And I think he's maybe going to say something about that today. Some of you may already be familiar with Dr. Kirkland's name and his work because it's received significant national press coverage just in the past few weeks. Editors of the journal Science selected the work of Dr. Kirkland and his team as one of the top 10 groundbreaking scientific achievements for the year 2011. The Mayo Clinic study, the first to eliminate the effects of aging on mice. Now, get that. They've eliminated aging in mice, so there might be hope. He's going to talk about it. Received worldwide attention. In fact, in November, Economist had a full-page story about it, and if you're a Saturday Night Live person, you got to see mice running around the stage on Saturday Night Live, and Jim may say something about this. The research is an important step in the quest to improve health span, not necessarily living a longer life, but a healthier, more productive one. Please join me in a warm Naples welcome for Dr. Jim Kirkland.
Thank you very much, Jim. I wanted to thank you and Carmen for our discussions this morning and for the kind introduction, and also Dave Rissmiller and Anne and all of you for inviting me here. I wanted to also extend my greetings or the greetings of John Noseworthy, our CEO, who, as Jim mentioned, couldn't be here because of the tragic accident that occurred. So what I'm going to speak to you briefly about is a little bit on aging, what it is, what we can do about it potentially, what some of the ramifications of that might be. And you're probably all aware that the proportion of individuals who are older around the world is increasing quite dramatically. In fact, in the United States, the fastest growing segment of our population are people over the age of 85 years. By 2050, that segment of the population will have increased fourfold. If we look at developing countries and developed countries like China, there's going to be a drastic increase in the proportion of elderly individuals. So that partly because of the one child per family policy that they had, by 2030, there are going to be well over 20% of people in China over the age of 65, probably upwards of 25%. That's already a quarter of the world's population. So South America has a huge increase in the proportion of elderly individuals. So this is quite a demographic shift that we're facing. That's good. We can expect to live longer. But there are potentially some problems associated with that, and that's that when I was in medical school, I was always taught the biggest risk factor for around 99% of the major chronic diseases, things like dementias or cancers or diabetes or atherosclerosis causing heart attacks and strokes, the biggest risk factor for those things was aging. And we always moved down to the next risk factor on the list, every lecturer did when I was in medical school, because they said, well, it's aging, there's nothing we can do about it, so let's do something about high blood pressure, high blood sugar, or high fat in the blood, or something like that, which is much lower on the list, but we can do something about it. So I started, and my colleagues around the world have been asking, why can't we do something about how aging predisposes to chronic disease? Can we cut the intersection between aging processes and risk of onset of chronic disease? And that's become very interesting, especially over the last 2 to 3 years. There's been groundbreaking work occurring around the world, actually looking at that intersection. Why do older people get cancer? Why do older people get dementia? What's the link between these processes? And can we sever that link? So you probably all know what aging is. But I defy you to try to define it. It's a really hard thing to define. There are many definitions out there. None of them has really held up over time. The one that has sort of stuck over the last 50 to 60 years is one that says that aging is a universal process. One quality of it is that it's universal. That means it's more than normal. Normal means you affect a substantial proportion of a population, but not necessarily everybody. Aging processes are universal. If you live long enough, they are going to occur. So that's one characteristic of aging processes. Another is that they're progressive. They're tied to the passage of time. And another is that they're inherent or intrinsic. If you lived in a cave underground, you would still undergo aging changes. So the environment can modulate the rate at which these things occur, but they will occur all the same. So the three characteristics of aging processes are that they're universal, progressive, and intrinsic. And you begin aging from the time of conception on. So the process is a lifelong process. It has so far defied biochemical definition, although we're getting closer and closer to having good biochemical definitions of what aging is. And that has frustrated research over time. But as I mentioned, some great advances have occurred in the last few years, which are interesting. Now, one part of the aging process we call the senescent phase of the lifespan. And that's when senescence begins, when your chance of living through the next year is less than your chance of living through the current year. Your highest chance of dying is at birth. And then your chance of dying decreases. And you enter a period of stability where your chance of living through the next year is roughly the same as your chance of living through the current year. Then you enter the senescent phase of the lifespan, where the senescent phase of the aging process, where your chance of living through the next year is less than your chance of living through the current year. I don't know if anyone would hazard a guess about what age that is at in humans, but I'll tell you, it's 28 and a half. Another feature of the aging process in humans is that there's a fixed upper limit to the lifespan. And indeed, that occurs in most of the mammals and many other species. So that's called the maximum lifespan. And in humans, that's 122.45 years. That's the upper limit to the lifespan. Now, there are interventions that have been found in lower animals, including in mammals like rats and mice, and even some things that may occur in humans that can impact maximum lifespan and actually push that out. There are around 400 mutations that have been found across species that will do this, and they all cluster on a series of pathways that are related to what happens if you, just after having eaten your lunch, have caloric restriction. So across species, caloric restriction delays the rate at which aging processes occur and pushes out maximum lifespan. So this has proven a fertile ground, these single gene mutations and these caloric restriction pathways, in trying to understand where there are drug targets that we can modulate the process by. If they're single genes, it means a single protein or a group of proteins are being made. If there are pathways related to caloric restriction, there are drug targets. So that's one interesting thing. Another concept that only recently hit the basic biology of aging community, because I've got one foot in the basic biology of aging community and another as a clinical geriatrician, is that maybe 2.5 years ago, the basic biologists figured out in a meeting that was held at the NIH that increasing lifespan at all costs may not be the greatest thing in the world. These calorically restricted mice, they may live a lot longer, but they are not happy. They're thin. If a mouse is going to be eaten by a cat, it's going to be the runted little calorically restricted mouse that can't get away because it's too weak and too lazy to get away. And it doesn't think very well either. So I think people began to realize that it might be better to come up with interventions that could increase what we call health span as opposed to lifespan at all costs. You probably don't want to live to be 122.45 and feel like you're 122.45. It might be better to live to be 105 or 110 and feel like you're 40. Sounds flippant, but actually this is what tends to happen in families where people live to be 100. So in centenarian families, these families where there is an inherited tendency to live to be to advanced old age. And you probably know people like this. These people tend to be highly functional throughout their lives. Many might even retire in their 80s or 90s. And then they get ill and they die very quickly. So that's called compression of morbidity. This is recapitulated in some of these single gene mutations that I talked about in lower animals. So our goal as a center, and the increasing goal around the world in the basic biology of aging community, is to attack health span. How can we increase health span? How can we delay reduce the part of the lifespan when people are frail and are suffering from chronic disease and are not fully functional? So that's actually been quite a change in mindset over the last few years, which I think is quite exciting. I've been lucky in my move to Mayo. We've got almost 50 geriatricians. We've got around 100 scientists who are interested full-time or part-time in the biology of aging, and we've managed to begin to pull the groups together. And there have been some interesting advances over the last couple of years at Mayo and elsewhere, but I'll tell you about one advance that I was lucky enough to participate in. And this is very much a team effort. Everything we do at Mayo is a team effort. I'll digress a little bit. I'll tell you that there was a guy, Leonard Hayflick, who in the late 1950s discovered that if you take cells from people, put them in tissue culture, they'll divide a certain number of times, and then they'll stop dividing. So there's a finite number of times that a progenitor cell taken from any person can divide in culture before it stops dividing. And he called that cellular senescence. It was actually prescient for him to call it that. Nobody believed it had anything to do with aging because he couldn't find these cells in people and all the rest of it. But then around 15 years ago, some people in California found a way that you can actually identify these cells using a staining method based on an enzyme that's in these cells. And they found that the abundance of these cells increases with increasing age in a variety of tissues. Their numbers are very small of these senescent cells. Even in a 90-year-old, in certain tissues, the maximum percentage of cells that you might find are senescent is around 10%. Many tissues, there are very few of these cells. But then another exciting discovery came about, and it was found that these cells that get senescent in culture after being passage a number of times. First, they don't die. And second, they produce a lot of things that damage everything around them. Then someone had the idea, well, maybe this is a defense mechanism against cancer, because the pathways that induce a cell to become senescent are the pathways that are turned on by mutations that occur in cancer and other kinds of cell damage. So these cells stop dividing, they don't die, they produce things that kill stuff around them, and you find them in the center of cancers, and it seems to be a defense mechanism. It's like rolling thunder in the Vietnam War when a firebase was surrounded. They'd call the artillery onto themselves This is a way that a small group of these cells can form in the middle of a cancer and call in the immune system and take out those cells and everything around them. So these cells actually have a beneficial function, especially in younger individuals. But when you start over time, because of various damage-related processes like shortening of the length of chromosomes or reactive oxygen species, free radicals, all of these things that you might have heard about, that can drive cells into a senescent state. And once you get a certain number of them, they start depressing the way the immune system works. So they start accumulating. And paradoxically, they can actually increase the likelihood that a cancer will spread. So we had the idea, maybe we should figure out a way of removing these cells and seeing if they really do anything. So we took a gene which drives these cells to become senescent, and we attached a suicide gene to it, so that when the gene gets turned on that is normally driven by these cells, this suicide protein gets made, and that suicide protein is only activated if we give the animals a drug. So we can make animals that just behave like any other aging animal, but what we can do is give them a drug that'll clear the senescent cells, kill off these precancerous cells that produce these factors that damage other tissues around them. We didn't know what would happen. I thought we'd walk in and we would find, you know, all the animals lying on their back, their feet up in the air, you know, another you know, horrendous amount of money spent on an experiment going up in smoke. But we gave the animals, we rebred these animals onto an accelerated aging background, Jan van Dersen and others in our group, and because we didn't want to wait 4 or 5 years for the experiment to be done. We gave the animals either the drug or their brothers and sisters didn't get the drug, and they had an increase in their health span. They didn't get age-related muscle wasting. They didn't lose the fat under their skin and get wrinkling of the skin. They didn't get cataracts. Their activity levels were high. All of these things were quite substantially delayed. In other words, removing these senescent cells seems to have affected multiple processes that delayed the loss of health span in these animals. So that's the thing that caught everybody by surprise. I mean, we were somewhat surprised ourselves. We gave these animals the drug for over a year, and you know, we didn't see adverse effects and all the rest of it. We don't know if this is going to work in other aging settings with chronological aging. We certainly don't know if this will work in humans at this point. We have to design drugs that will target these cells. There's an awful lot of work to be done. But what it does mean is that there might be some light at the end of the tunnel, because other things that we're finding are, for example, that we delay brain aging changes that occur in these animals. So we delay the inflammation and fibrosis that give rise ultimately to Alzheimer's disease and other things in these animals. We're looking at how, at the moment, these animals have a delay in cancer, because probably these senescent cells are precancerous cells. So by taking them out, we might be delaying cancer. But that's early work that is only beginning to emerge. So we might have a way of actually impacting these processes. Another way that we can impact these processes is that there are some drugs that have been found that prevent senescent cells from damaging the cells that are around them. One of them you might have heard of is called rapamycin. It's in very early studies in experimental animals. But we're quickly getting to the point where if we can do this in mice using various approaches, we might be able to, in the next few years, begin to envisage preclinical studies and potentially clinical studies in humans. It's still science fiction. There's an awful lot to be done. But there's some hope of that. So what we're in the process of doing is trying to set up an infrastructure so that we can take these interventions that are beginning to appear. And I should mention, we had a meeting in Holland in October, a group of people from around the world. We got everybody in a really nice room, locked the door, threw away the key for a day, and got them all to brainstorm. You know, it was just a brainstorming session. And we came up with 37 different ways, molecular pathways and targets, that we could potentially use to attack this process. We already know that two work, the rapamycin approach and the removing senescent cells approach. So there are a bunch of things that we might be able to do. Many of them still science fiction, many of them still on the drawing board, but some of them have actually achieved reality now, at least in mice. So what we need to do is think of how can we take this to the next step? And there are a number of barriers to that. One of them is, as we mentioned, I'm a geriatrician, and there are 9,000 geriatricians in the United States. Only 12 have basic science grants from the National Institute on Aging to study the fundamental processes of aging. So there's a big disconnect between the clinical community and the basic science community. We need to bridge that gap. We need to have clinicians who are trained in the basic science of aging so they can do the drug trials that we need to do. And we need to have these people within the next 3 to 5 years. So we've had to embark on a crash series of training programs to try to get people ready to do these clinical trials. We have to think of the right ways to do clinical trials. What settings will we do it in? Because we can't do health span or lifespan studies in humans in under who knows how many years. So we have to think of other measures which we're using to estimate the burden of senescent cells in individuals and look for situations where these agents might be useful. And there are several where they appear to be, and that will be in reducing side effects of cancer chemotherapy, which sounds weird, but a lot of those side effects result from cellular senescence, and some other settings. So it's going to be, we're in the process of setting up the clinical infrastructure so that we can put these drugs into trial. One of the things that's interesting that we've done at Mayo is we've got 4 laboratories that we have linked together for setting up this sort of pipeline to go from the bench to the bedside. One of them is what we call a mouse frailty phenotyping lab. So this is a lab for mice where they're running on treadmills, they're pulling weight sort of things to see what their strength is like. We're measuring their food intake, their activity, how much they jump up in cages to try to grab food at the top of the cage, what their respiration is like. They get CAT scans, they get MRIs, they get all kinds of stuff. They get all kinds of blood tests. So they go through a full fitness, you know, gold-plated executive exam every week. And we've done the same things with our human subjects. So we've got a clinical physiology of aging laboratory where we do the same things in humans as we do in the mice. And we've got an interesting person who helps to do this. And he's a physiotherapist, but also a PhD molecular biologist. He's written a lot of stuff about setting up physiotherapy techniques for older individuals and tests of what function is like and frailty. And he's done the same thing with mice. So we're trying to cross those two things. Then we've got a third lab in a retirement community in Rochester where we've got 4 apartments that people can live in. We've got video monitoring and all kinds of things so that we can see over a matter of days or weeks what impact some of these treatments might have on people, as well as interventions like dietary interventions or piloting devices to help keep people independent living at home. Then the fourth lab that we're just in the process of developing is what we call Mission Control. And this will be a lab where we actually use devices that are non-obtrusive that can be sewn into people's clothing, where we can monitor people living at home. Mayo bought out part of the radio frequency spectrum when television went from analog to digital, put up antennas on all our buildings, and we've got a bunch of engineers who design devices for monitoring astronauts and soldiers as their day job. Their night job is to make those devices for elderly people. So we're developing the capability of monitoring what happens to older people living in their homes, both from a diagnostic point of view, but also so that we can try out some of these treatments once we're ready to do so in that population. So there are a lot of exciting things that are happening along those lines. Now, cellular senescence is one approach. You know, these are the zombie cells that cause a lot of damage that we found if you get rid of will extend health span. But we also need to replace or repair damaged tissues. One good thing that we found, though, with these INCATAC, we call them mice, that we give the drug to, even if we start the drug in later life, once they've got some changes that have occurred related to aging, some of them we can partially reverse, and others we can at least freeze to some extent. So what we are going to need is a way of replacing and reverting some of the changes that have occurred to tissues that getting rid of senescent cells won't fix. You know, getting rid of senescent cells may stop further progression. Using some of these drugs that interfere with the things that senescent cells might produce might stop progression or slow it down. But what we need to do is to replace damaged cells. So we have a program within the Aging Center in the Regenerative Biology of Aging where we take cells from fat tissue, which most people don't mind giving up, and we turn them into other cell types and then put them back into animals. And there are human trials now going on too, where this has been done in 7 countries in Europe with cardiac, with heart cell progenitor replacement in people with severe heart failure who are elderly. And that's been very promising. So we need to do some of the things that the ancient surgeons in China 3,000 BC, wrote about. We need to get rid of the dead tissue, the bad tissue. We need to put in good tissue. So we need a two-pronged kind of approach. And we're actively trying to position the research community so we can do that. I think the most important thing, though, will be is if we can, with some of these interventions, actually hit this intersection between aging and chronic disease. So one of the things that we're doing with these mice, where we can get rid of these senescent cells and slow down the rate at which aging processes occur, is that we're either giving them diets that, for example, cause obesity and the diabetes associated with it to see if we can stop the diabetes by getting rid of these cells, or we're breeding them with animals that are predisposed to human-like diseases, like Alzheimer's disease, atherosclerosis, which is what leads to heart attacks and strokes, and various cancers. So those programs are going on at the moment with hundreds and hundreds of mice where we're breeding them, and then the goal will be to remove the senescent cells and see if, in fact, it's true whether we can delay onset of these age-related diseases one disease at a time. I don't know if that'll work, but it's exciting. And so far it has worked in the case of brain gliosis, as I mentioned, and also it looks like it's working with respect to cancer. So there could be some dramatic changes that occur if all of this becomes more than science fiction, which it is at the moment. There's a long way to go. As I mentioned, there's maybe light at the end of the tunnel, but there are a lot of potential yes-no points, a lot of potential red-green lights along the route to actually bringing these treatments to reality. But sooner or later, one or another of the 37 or so different approaches might work. And the notion here is, can we increase health span? Can we delay the onset of age-related diseases as a group? Is this a better way of attacking age-related diseases than by trying to go for them one at a time? If you got rid of all cancers, you'd add at most 2 years to the life expectancy of humans. If you got rid of all strokes, all heart attacks, 2 years. Because another thing will follow them. Like if you don't die of a heart attack, you might die of a dementia or a cancer, for example. Can we shift the whole thing? And our goal, it may be totally unrealistic, but our goal is to try to add at least 5 years to human health span within the next 15 to 20 years. Whether we can do that, I don't know. But you could imagine that if you had people who are healthy for longer, there'll be a lot of social implications to this. And it's probably not far off time to begin thinking about what some of those would be. I'd argue that we've already been through some of this. We started with the retirement age under Bismarck being 55. And that's gradually increased as health span has increased because of improvements in medical care, the economies, education, and other things which have driven up median life expectancy. I think, you know, I finished my training. I'm still always being trained, but I finished my training when I was in my mid-30s. It means that I'll have been in school for much longer than I might work. If we could increase health span, it might be possible to have people getting the kind of training that they're getting nowadays for some of the professions or research to have a longer productive period in their lifespan. It might be possible to push out the retirement age a bit, because most people that I speak to like if they felt up to it and they really wanted to do it, they want to either work, or most retired people that I speak to say that they're busier in their retirement than they were during their work, and they want to remain busy. So can we do that, and would that drive down healthcare costs? And there's an interesting statistic that a colleague of mine from New York found. And that's that the last 2 years of life of a person who dies at 100 costs the healthcare system one-third of the last 2 years of life of a person who dies at 70. So this compression of morbidity that we find in people who live to advanced old age could actually drive down healthcare costs if we can increase health span. And furthermore, if we have a population living longer, even if the terminal phase of the lifespan, when things start to fall apart, stays the same, as a percentage of lifespan, it'll decrease. So this is a way that we might be able to tackle healthcare costs in the next 10, 20, 30 years that most people haven't begun to think about, because I think a lot of people outside the basic biology of aging community haven't really appreciated how fast all of this stuff is occurring. And it's occurring at breathtaking speed. It's extremely exciting. We're trying to bridge together the various aging research centers across the US and in Europe. We're trying to, we've begun talking with others about creating an Apollo-like project so that we can try to move this faster. And we're trying to think of ways where we can take these interventions and get them into clinical practice faster than is usually the case because of by getting things on regulatory paths early and doing multiple things concurrently. Whether we'll be successful or not, I don't know, but it's extremely exciting. This has been exciting for me, but it's been exciting for my colleagues, but it's also been exciting for students. Now our aging center is getting half the MD-PhD students. A big change. When I did my training 20 odd years ago, hardly anybody was interested in aging. But now there might be some interventions that work, and where there are interventions that have a hope of working, even if they don't ultimately work, if there are interventions that have a hope of working, you get people interested in moving into the field. And that seems to be happening. And I think it's going to be very important that we get our younger trainees interested in this area because of the demographics that are occurring and everything else. So with that, I'll conclude. I wanted to thank you very much for inviting me here and for a nice lunch.
Thank you. I know I've learned a lot, and I'm sure all our members have learned a lot today. Very, very interesting, and I'm looking forward to 104, 120, and Ann can hardly wait. In the meantime, our guest over here, our speaker, our student said, gee, that's great news, that's great news. She's all excited about what you had to say. For speaking, we have three benefits for you. Number one, we have a membership cap of around 410, and we're at that level. We have 370-some on the wait list, but because you have been a speaker, if you want to become a member, you can immediately become a member next session.
Oh, wow.
All right? Now, we don't pay airfare back and forth, but you can immediately become a member. Okay. Seriously. Number two, we have two books for you to take home with you. Number one, on Naples, Florida.
Thank you.
And number two, the Marco Island book.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Well, we have a few minutes left for some questions, and obviously this has generated a great deal of interest. Barbara, where are you? Okay, some of the questions relate to the Mayo Clinic on a larger scale, so maybe between the two of you can sort of ham and egg the responses. But the first one...
Oh, also, I'd just add, Barbara has cards back there so that you can get in touch with her if you want written materials about any of this information. She can guide you on the path to that.
The first one is, how does Mayo fund this research?
Yeah, that's an interesting question and a large part of my life. We've been fortunate to have some donors who have provided funding. Our aging center is only 4 years old now. It started off as a program within one of the departments in Department of Internal Medicine in Rochester, but now it spreads across Mayo, which is a very big organization, 56,000 employees. But it spreads across all departments and all branches of Mayo. So we've had Mayo support, we've had philanthropic support, and we have a lot of grants from the NIH. As hard as they are to get, we've got around 90 grants that are of the order of $200,000 to $250,000 a year each across the aging center. So that's been important. There are a couple of foundations that help out. The Ellison Foundation, the Ted Nash Foundation, the Paul Glenn Foundation. One of the things that philanthropy has helped us with is in funding high-risk, high-potential gain projects. You all in this room understand that because most of you are entrepreneurs and you're used to taking risk if there's going to be a potential big payoff. Scientists aren't that way. And scientists, the way that we get funded through the NIH is that other scientists review our work, and we're extremely conservative. So the funding that you can get as a scientist is only really for projects where there's a pretty guaranteed outcome. So that's hardly a good definition of research. One of the advantages that we've had is that we can put small amounts of money into extremely high-risk projects that no granting agency would ever touch. And some of those pay off, like this Incotac mouse paid off. Now we're in a position to apply for all kinds of grant money because we've shown that it actually works, so we can take it to the next level. But that's been an extremely important benefit of our funding situation.
This is a fairly fundamental question. In the animal kingdom, the grass eaters generally live twice as long as the carnivores. Strong opinion there. Is there a connection with humans? Do vegetarians age more slowly?
It's really hard to know that in human studies. There is some evidence that vegans have a delay in certain age-related diseases. Whether that affects maximum lifespan is really, really hard to tell in humans. There are clearly big effects of nutritional state on the rate that aging changes occur in lower experimental animals. As I mentioned before, one of the biggest impacts that you can make on maximum lifespan is through caloric restriction, and that occurs across species. Also, as I mentioned, it's not always desirable to be calorically restricted. A calorically restricted mouse, for example, cannot withstand cold exposure. Doesn't have enough fat tissue to be able to do that. So there's sort of a trade-off. And then there are certain things in the diet, certain amino acids that relate to how proteins get made and how cells turn over, and we believe, could be wrong, relate to how fast cellular senescence occurs that may be other keys that we can use for designing drug interventions. Interestingly, caloric restriction, which extends maximum lifespan, also delays onset of cellular senescence in tissues like fat tissue. Fat tissue is the largest organ in humans, in most humans. Depends on the person, but in many humans, it's the largest organ. It's got a lot of progenitor cells that turn over. You're constantly making new fat cells throughout your life. As fat cells die off, you're making new ones. So you've got these progenitor cells that can give rise to new fat cells. This is where we see the biggest accumulation of senescent cells, is in fat tissue. And it seems to be at the nexus of processes involved in longevity. It probably makes sense that caloric restriction would increase lifespan. It's known that from yeast up, from single-celled organisms, from yeast up, that caloric restriction does this. And it's probably a way to allow the species to outlive a period of food deprivation, so that the species can survive through that and continue to propagate. Also, caloric restriction enhances stress resistance to prevent stresses from killing individuals. And that's probably because when there's a famine, you're eating garbage, and garbage is bad for you. And so you have to have systems to protect yourself against that. You know, if you're a mouse, you're going to be eating things that you shouldn't be eating as a mouse. So these systems are built into us right from our evolution from yeast up. So these same pathways are the ones that you can target that affect the bad things that senescent cells produce, the so-called senescence-associated secretory phenotype, long word, SASP we call it, the things that they produce. So there's this amazing connection between food supply, fat tissue, and the rate at which aging-related changes occur. You might have heard about resveratrol, you know, the stuff that's in red wine and black olives, black, dark, really dark chocolate. You know, it's flavonoids that are produced by plants. If you think about it, those are dying plants. I mean, black olives are dying olives. Red wine is made from dying grapes. So this is a signal that the animal kingdom has adapted to detect that the plant kingdom is in trouble. So this way, the organism knows that a famine might be coming, because you're not going to eat garbage like black olives unless you're forced to. So we try to take advantage of all these things.
Here's a fairly fundamental question. How do you determine the existence of dementia in mice and rats?
We were talking about that earlier at breakfast. It's actually tricky. Very tricky. Because it's easy to detect cognitive dysfunction of confusion and things in young mice. And you can do things like you use something like called a Morris water maze, for example. So it's a pool of water, and it's got a platform which is just under the surface of the water, which if the mouse stands on, it can stop swimming, and it's going to be able to, you know, sit around and not drown. And what you do is you put different symbols around the side of the water maze, and then you put the mouse in several times and see how long it takes to swim to find the platform, because it can tell from the symbols where the platform is. The trouble with these tests that are really good in young mice for looking at cognitive function don't work well in old mice because they've got cataracts. They can't see. So we've had to spend umpteen hours, weeks, months, figuring out how you test cognitive function in mice that can't see properly. And it is very important because this age-related gliosis, we call it, is the same thing as what has been called mild cognitive impairment in humans, where you get progressive fibrosis in the front parts of the brain, the parts of the brain that control memory. And a certain proportion of these people go on to get Alzheimer's, but a lot of people don't, you know, so You might find, as you get older, that you have some memory troubles. My wife tells me that I have those from time to time. And that's partly related to this progressive gliosis that occurs. This we can stop in these mice. So we have to be able to test cognitive function.
Jim, thank you very much. Thank you. It's great to have you here.
I know you're all getting up, but Jim Campbell and I both forgot to do something.